Broadcasting worldwide from the Toadsuck Studio in beautiful central Arkansas. It's currently under thunderstorm and tornado watch, so beauty in the eye of the beholder. But you're listening to Bad Choices and Bourbon. I'm your host, Dan Decker, and my guest this week is my good buddy John from Twitter, but also, you know, we've connected in a little bit more than just hanging out on Twitter. We've got a nice little WhatsApp thread going and everything. So, John, man, it's been a minute to get you here, but welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan. Good to see you.
Yeah, no, it's actually, we've got the video going. So for the folks who want to see that on YouTube, you'll be able to, you can watch a couple of old guys shoot the shit for better or worse.
Yeah, I'm one of the older people in this group. I mean, I'm older than you. I'm older than, I don't know if there's anyone, in our little group.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Maybe she's not in the WhatsApp thread, but Kelly, she might be in that same ballpark.
Somebody's got to be the oldest and wisest.
That's right. I fit that role sometimes at the place that I work. I'm definitely one of the elders.
There you go.
So is that your background there now? Is that actually a picture you took?
Yes, that is a picture that I took. One of my several hobbies, I like to ride my bike around, and I live in a part of Connecticut where there's a lot of reservoirs and water and thing. And that was early one morning out at a reservoir, probably about 10 miles from my house. And you can see the kind of the mist on the water. It's just, you can see the bike in the background, as I like to call it, the Enterprise B back there, which there's a story behind that.
I love it.
But, you know, it's just so nice out there. And I take a rest there because there's a hill just off screen. There's a hill. So I like to take a little rest. Just
in the wrong direction.
And then try to old man my way up the hill. So
well, there you go. Man, yeah. I love riding bike. I haven't had one in years, and I've always threatened to get one, and that was going to be my health routine, was to just go riding bike. Low impact, you know, the city here is relatively flat and has become more bike friendly. I used to be able to, you could tear through town, on a bike, taking all the shortcuts, almost as fast as you could get over on a car. A couple decades ago.
I like it so much. I mean, I don't like running because it is a little higher impact. Mm-hmm. I don't like treadmills, and, you know, I have a stationary bike, which I barely ever use because, you know, sometimes the weather is just what it is. To get outside, you know, I have a bunch of different routes, and you can always come up with another route. There's always something to see. You know, I understand the cars don't love cyclists. I don't love cyclists when I'm in a car. But, you know, there's a little bit of give and take, but it's just nice to get out. You actually get somewhere, you know, instead of being on the thing where it's the same. You're just not moving.
It's
so boring.
It's a good workout.
It is a good workout.
You're using everything. Plus, you're using your mind in a way that you're kind of subconsciously, you know, it's the thing doing the work to keep you upright. And so you're flexing a different kind of muscle. And so that's cool. Yeah. I really need to, one of our key failings as parents is none of our kids know how to ride a bike. It's kind of and I've talked to other, folks who have kids around their age, and it seems to be kind of a thing with it's not as important as it was to us to be able to, you know, that was the way we got out. That's how we went and saw our friends. They have Xbox and internet and Snapchat and TikTok. And so the impetus to go out and socially interact or be away from, you know, why would you want to leave the leisure of all
You've
of that
so
in
much.
Your room?
One of my youngest rode with me a lot. Like, we did a couple of 50-mile charity rides together. That was great. It's so nice to be able to do something like that with your kids. Like, I when my oldest was 12, he was playing ice hockey. And I loved it. And I started to play grown-up ice hockey, you know, the old man league. And he stopped liking it as a kid because it got so competitive.
Yeah.
Like, there comes a point where either you have to get into like travel leagues and you have to take it really seriously or you have to stop.
Yep.
And he couldn't stand being yelled at by coaches and the other kids. And he stopped. And when he got old enough, when he was 18, he played with me.
Yeah.
As a grown up. And the guys that I played with are so nice and they were so welcoming. Like when they, you know, every team sent a couple of guys to the All-Star team, you know, and I didn't even ask them to do this, but they all voted for him to go.
Oh, that's sweet.
Like me, he was, you know, not a talent.
A hobby player.
But they were so nice. And it was great to be on the ice, you know, with my son. I mean, I just felt it was just such a great experience.
Well, you know, and I think you touch on something that we forget, that this shit is supposed to be fun, man.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that isn't to detract from those who enjoy, but my sister and my niece were in some of that competitive stuff with softball. And, you know, on the surface, like they say, my niece enjoyed it, but I don't know, you know, and maybe she did. And she was really good at it and still is. But I think she's kind of stepped away from it because, like you said, it's exhausting. But for us, like, you just went and played Little League, and yeah, it was a little bit competitive, and we wanted to win. Yeah, you want to win, but it's not like at the end of the day, everybody gets an ice cream cone from the frickin' snack machine or whatever.
Yeah, and like in this adult league, I mean, there were six tiers of skill level. We were at tier six, which is the lowest, and like we wanted to win, and you know, like a couple of times we won, and we got a team picture, you know, like a t-shirt. We got a t-shirt. And so you wanted to win, but like you didn't really care if you didn't win. I mean, and that was perfect.
Well, that was perfect for all of us. For me, most recent memory was in a bowling league with some friends. And this was easily a decade ago, maybe more. But one of the people took it incredibly seriously. And the rest of them were just like, man, we just want to show up and throw the ball at some pins. Like, I am a terrible bowler. My handicap with people were like, you know, I got called sandbagger all the time because I would have a one-off really good night. And my handicap was ridiculous.
Right.
But on average, you know, it was the handicap's the only thing that kept me from being just awful. And, but it was league and, you know, yeah, so there was competition and there was stuff on the line, but man, not that serious. And I only did it once because it took something that I was moderately enthused about, which is bowling and wanting to be a better bowler and having a good time with it, and turned it into a competitive thing that I'm just not interested in that level of competition. I want to do well. I like to challenge myself. I like to, I see it more as, you know, I want it to be a kind of a quote unquote steel sharpened steel situation where me and my peers in the group are working to make each other better in kind of a competitive way.
Well, that's why D&D is so great.
Exactly.
You're not competing against anybody. You're all working together. And even I always wanted to be the dungeon master for some reason. I played from, you know, from a very young age.
Have you ever got to DM?
Oh yeah. As a kid, I did. I mean, and now all of my kids actually play now. And they're, you know, my oldest is 28 and my youngest is 20, and they all have regular games of various. My daughter lives in California. My two sons live here in Connecticut. But, you know, even the DM is not there to play against the players.
Yep.
You know, the DM is there to make the experience good for everybody. And there's no competition. I mean, sometimes you have, you know, the occasional chaotic, neutral, chaotic, evil character who wants to, like, be the disruptor, but that's not the same thing as competing against everybody. Everybody's there trying to have as good an experience as they can. So
yeah. Well, when I DM, you know, and I gotta take a minute to brag. First of all, if you want to play, I got a slot at the table. We're putting together a game.
I don't know if I have that kind of commitment, but
I can feel that. trust me. But there's also opportunity to. I'm planning a. They just dropped an entire book of one-shots for any particular level. So like the Candlekeep Mysteries, you know, it's you decide, okay, we're going to be level 5 players, and here's a level 5 adventure. It's a one and done, you know, so no commitment, maybe outside of a couple of sessions, and something we can have some fun with. So we'll talk about that.
Let's talk about that.
I got a couple of people, Kelly, Commander Kelly and Stevie Lee interested. But with that, and you know, that in mind, it isn't DM versus player. It's it is players versus the encounter.
Yeah.
And the encounter, like we, our, one of our biggest mantras is let the dice tell the story. You know, my favorite replies are, you can try and let's see what happens, you know, because the player, should be allowed to say, I want to do this. Well, there are mechanics built into the game that let you do that. You just have to be creative enough. You know, if your player says, I want to hug the bad guy, well, that's a grapple. Let's see how that goes. Roll right. me this. And boom. Okay, so yeah, you grappled a stone golem. Good job. And now that gives, you know, that took away some of his benefits. And then somebody was like, I want to climb up its back and wrap my cape around its head and blind it. I was like, well, we got to break it down. You can't do both of those things at the same time. So, you know, athletics check to climb the golem, bam, passed it. You got to give me an animal handling check to make sure you don't fall off yep. the golem. Next round, dex check, you know, sleight of hand. Did you? Oh, yeah. And they killed it, man. They, you know, they spot smart and disabled it to the point right. that it couldn't beat them. And then they just literally hacked it to pieces.
That's great. I mean, you know, obviously the rules in D&D are just there as, I mean, there are their guidelines and,
exactly.
And for the DM, it's all about preparation. You know, mm-hmm. if you're prepared, you're going to be able to handle those situations.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that always killed me as a DM and that I had to really learn how to structure a world for this is that as a DM and you're putting together an adventure, you got a storyline in your mind. Mm-hmm. Players are going to do this and then they're going to do that. And then they're going to learn a piece of information and then they're going to do the other thing. And then the actual players come in and they go right to step five, you know, mm-hmm. and you're like, wait a minute. But you got to be ready. You got to yeah. realize that they're not going to necessarily follow your storyline, and you've got to be able to account for that and still make the thing work.
So what I and that's the key, the last bit there, make the thing work. What I have kind of formulated is to keep everyone from being overwhelmed, because you can get quested and side quested and no one's keeping great notes, including the DM, you know. You have to keep things in a manageable realm. You should have, your players should only ever have three options, right? You can do A, B, or C. You're not limiting their choice, but they're not overwhelming them either. And you get a hook into each one of those. And they say, okay, well, I want to go with B. Well, guess what? A and C now become A, B, and there's a new C. That when you get to the goal of that one thing, you still have these other options. As a DM, you can't railroad that, but you and the ability to think on the fly, the players can't ruin your story. You can let unexpected circumstances upset your narrative, but right. you could also choose those unexpected circumstances to move you're playing chess. If the players take you to step five, well, then steps 2, 3, and 4 become steps 6, 7, and 8.
Yeah, you can, sure.
You know, just shuffle.
But, you know, you have to, I think that you have to have that in mind when you're yep. structuring things.
Exactly.
That it has to be fluid. You have to be, you know, if you're too locked in as a DM, then,
yep.
you know, it's not going to be as good as if you're, but if you're prepared, and then you can handle those situations like you're talking about, you want to hug the golem or whatever, you know, I mean, that then you know, then that's great, then you can accommodate that.
Well, and two, you know, previous generations of DMs would have said, that's dumb, you can't do that, you know, why are you calling it a hug, you need to grapple, you know, what is a hug if not a grapple, you know, I mean, obviously, hey man,
yeah, no, I mean I feel like the whole thing is the rules are a guideline, they're a framework, and then, you know, you do what makes it work.
Well, like I tell people that it's on the title, it's on the tin, it's a player's handbook and a dungeon master's guide.
Yeah.
They're not rule books, you know. There's a set of basic rules that we all have to agree on, and those are just the mechanics of the game. It doesn't tell you yeah. It tells you how the game works, not how the game is played.
I mean, I got to the point, and I don't want this whole conversation to be about D&D, but I got to the point where, like, I had one of those players who, you know, like, he'll start looking monsters up in the monster manual.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to alter every single monster because I didn't want this guy to be able to look up the characteristics of the monster that he was meeting.
Yep.
It was supposed to be, you know, your character doesn't have the monster manual with him, so you're going to meet some things that aren't in the Monster Manual, and you're not going to know everything about it beforehand. And it was a little bit of a struggle. You know, you have one of those kind of rules lawyers, you know, where you're in a little bit of a struggle. And he was a nice guy. You know, it wasn't like we're going to kick him out of the group. But, like, you know, sometimes you gotta work around those obstacles a little
bit. Well, and it's a great parallel for life in
life in general.
I think so. Work around those obstacles. But it's
my favorite thing is when people start trying to ban D&D because it's satanic or whatever. Like,
oh yeah, we were well aware of the satanic panic. Our generation overlaps well there with Mazes and Monsters with Tom Hanks, and what a ridiculous. It was like a movie of the week, kids. Back in the day, they'd put on these awful TV movies that were essentially extended very special episodes. but yeah, no, I mean, honestly, I could talk D&D all day long with anybody. I mean, just like if we oops and start talking about Star Trek or sci-fi, you know. This show is also about just getting to know people outside of, you know, those kind of shared interests. That's what draws us together. But, you know, living in Connecticut, is that where you've been your whole life?
No, I'm not far. I mean, I grew up in northern New Jersey. New Jersey. It's really not New Jersey. It's more like New Jersey.
New Jersey?
It's even worse than New Jersey. New Jersey is like, if you're from Brooklyn, you might
but
say
New Jersey.
But
it's got an I in there. It's a little
New Chris Jersey. Caligero, who is basically, I think I encountered you through him on
Twitter.
Man,
he's great, isn't he? I love Chris. He's
and he grew up in New Jersey. And this is funny because he's more your age than mine, so he's a little younger than me, but every cultural reference that he comes up with, it just, you know, that's right in my wheelhouse.
Well, a good comedian is pan-generational. They're tapped into more, you know. I think where a lot of modern comedians fail is that they're focused on that one target audience. Chris is like, he appeals to everything. And I stumbled into him maybe a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, through it was the police chief video.
Right.
I went, oh,
right.
Classic. And I just pestered him enough till he followed me back.
The first one of his that I saw, I think, was how to speak New Jersey, you know.
Yes.
And it was just, ma, I'm doing a thing here, ma.
You loved it. Well, and Stevie Lee's she's native from New Jersey too.
Yeah.
So, well, and then Connecticut.
So through Chris, I think I met you, and I do want to talk about how I met you because
I'm all about me.
It's important. All right, good. Let's talk about you. And then that whole kind of Star Trek group. I mean, when I started off with Twitter, it was all politics.
No,
you know,
me
I mean,
too.
I was just so into like what's going on every day. You know, I'd wake up in the morning, and go, what new horrible thing has happened on Twitter? And it was really affecting my mental health, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to expand it, maybe end of 2019, middle end of 2019, beginning of 2020, I just started to expand more and more Star Trek, just more and more Star Trek people, because it was such a relief, such a breath of fresh air. The people, and you and I kind of follow and are followed by a lot of the same people now. I mean, and that's really through you. And it's been so much of an improvement to my everyday life that, yeah, half of my Twitter is still, you know, what horrible thing did Trump do? And half of it is, you know, here's a picture of Rom because he's my favorite Star Trek character.
He
actually is my favorite Star Trek character. But
right here.
And we can talk about that. Oh, there we go. Yeah. Rom. Nice. And so with you, here's the thing about you. I'm a pretty sarcastic, snarky guy. And Twitter is the perfect place for that.
It is.
And you said something. Now, I know now how much you love Captain Sisko. I didn't really know it at the time. So you said something in praise of Sisko. Isn't he the best? Or Avery Brooks, you know, and I said something snarky about how he overacts in every scene. And, you know, I said, sure, if you like the ham and the, you know, I don't know what I said. And I mean, at that point, you could have come back and said, yeah, you know, this guy, he doesn't get it, and just like block me or said, I don't want to have to do with anything to do with him. And you came back and you just said, you know what? I love this actor. I love this role. I named one of my kids after him, you know, and I just kind of took a second and went, you know, you don't have to be sarcastic and snarky every time. Here's a guy who sincerely, not only do you sincerely, you know, love that character and the actor, but in my case, for me, you took the time to kind of say, you know what, here's something that means something to me, and I want to let you know that. And something in me just kind of turned around there, and I went, yeah, you know, that's right. That's right.
Wow. Well, thanks for that.
No, I mean, thank you. And I just,
I remember
and my approach, but from there, I think I really began to branch out into that Star Trek community that's out there. And it's so good and has been so good for me. So, so thank you.
Oh, wow. I appreciate that. Yeah. Same for me. You know, I stumbled into, I had my friend, my good friend, Kevin. He'll be 2 years past coming up, April 23rd this year. Suddenly in the middle of the night, he didn't wake up the next day. But
well, that's such a shame.
It is. He was a good dude. And he was the one who challenged me to a lot of, new ideology, and, you know, helped me become a better critical thinker. So big influence on me. But he, you know, 2017, he had been on Twitter since way back. And so he was like, no, you really got to come back. Cause I was there for a while. I left, kind of quit social media altogether to get a head check, and, came back though, to be angry at politics, like intentionally angry at politics. And found there is a community there, the resistance, as it was,
yeah.
Hashtag resist. Right. And boy, I mean, hashtag toxic, honestly. And I found myself like getting into these follow back loops where, you know, everybody had to follow everybody back. And that's, you know, the whole point was more about how big you could get your followers list than it was about, you know, even quote the resistance, like even being politically minded. And I realized that was not a great headspace. And so I sat down one day and I said, Dan, to yourself, Dan, what is the thing that you like the most? Why aren't you engaging something you honestly love rather than something you are actively distasteful about? Mm-hmm. And the first answer was Star Trek. And so I went and I found, you know, a bunch of actor accounts and started following all of those, and somehow stumbled into Batleth Babe and, you know, Johnny Staggs. And from there, it brought in the rest of this community. And of course, there was this, you know, nexus point last year where we all started to think to kind of realize that Star Trek community was a thing, and also the pandemic. So it really, you know, there was an ember that sparked a wildfire, and we all got caught into this, you know, and I think we've all kind of collectively gone with the ebb and flow of, you know, we're all hype and excited, and then, you know, we all have to kind of take a breather and reassess what's happening in the community. And, you know, it isn't all sunshine and roses, but it is way better than where we were. In politics. And I think the difference is these are real people who are willing to engage in things outside of their passion, Star Trek. And, you know, like you and I and all the folks who've been on this show, and all the folks who I get the pleasure to speak with through DM, there's a real human connection there outside of we all love the same show or all love the same franchise. You know, and I don't know that there's ever been an opportunity where something like that fandom could bring people together in a, you know, it used to only be through conventions that we would get a connection back before the internet. And so those were fleeting moments of people that you knew you would love to spend more time with, but you just can't because distance, you know, we've all come to the same place, but we all have to go back to different places. And now we're just all in the same place, although we're from different endpoints. And yeah, it's been a huge improvement to me, and I've met so many great people, and had an opportunity to, you know, really grow the friends and family network. And, I appreciate you being a part of that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And I think that there's something about Star Trek that, yeah, there are toxic Star Trek fans, mm-hmm. know, definitely. But the fandom seems to me not to be as toxic as other fandoms, which mm-hmm. shall remain nameless, like Star Wars, where it just seems like that one just seems to draw. And I don't know if it's because the Star Trek world is so optimistic, mm-hmm. you know, and so humanistic, and other worlds are less so. Or maybe it's just that I think there's a process that you and I and other people in this group have done is a little bit of self-selection, that if there's a toxic element, it kind of gets cut out from the herd mm-hmm. and left by the wayside. And every now and then something intrudes, you know, into our little group that is a little bit toxic. And then, you know, there's almost like an immune reaction that kind of pushes back against it. So I think maybe there are other groups like that. I mean, and this is not a formal group. Obviously, there are people who are in and out, back and forth. It's really, I think, hundreds of people.
Oh, yeah.
In the end. And but something about it that has kept it so positive. Mm-hmm. And that's been great.
Well, and I think it's the fact that we all have a sense of in this together. And then we just come to reinforce each other that, you know, I've never been in a group of friends that is so like, you know, it's okay to say you're having a bad day and everyone's gonna be like, yeah, man, you know, I'm having a bad day too, but you kind of rock and let's rock this together. And you know, it's people will diminish that as something, but yeah, it really matters to be reminded that there are people out there who care about you and
yeah.
that, you know, saying I'm not great today isn't you know, it isn't pleading for clout. It's being honest with your friends. You just happen to have a platform where you can be honest with everybody, you know. And I think too, it's that, you know, we've been conditioned not to discuss our feelings and what they mean to us, and to kind of, you know, and people discussing their feelings openly makes other people uncomfortable a lot of times. And but that, you know, part of it is to say, hey, you know, that's not actually, it is okay to say you're not great. It is okay to commiserate.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe the positive side of the anonymity that social media gives you. I mean, that anonymity leads to a lot of people feeling enabled to be toxic, you know,
right.
And that's been a big problem. But on the other hand, I think it also enables people to kind of say, well, there's a layer of protection between me and all of this. I can actually, I can be open about mm-hmm. my feelings, and it's going to be okay. And we've seen some, you know, some incidents over the last couple of years where people really have taken a chance and kind of done that and come out and you know, express their feelings. And the group has, I think, done just fantastically well with that. And I agree with you. People will say, oh, it's, you know, everybody can just click on like, or say, oh, I know you're having a bad day, and say something sugary and you know, but you're right. It does matter. It does matter that people see it and they respond to it. And they, you know, they say, you know, if you want to talk offline, we can talk, you know, people are there. People yeah. are there. And especially at this particular time with the pandemic, it's been a tremendous boost to me personally. Well, and I think to a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. And definitely, you know, that plus being able to get the show going and have it as something to look forward to and kind of mark time for me mm-hmm. when there wasn't anything else to mark time has been important. But, you know, like that layer of protection, that anonymity there, you know, there is a bit of fabe to what I do on Twitter as the Commodore. You know, it's a little bit of play, and you know, in the name and the fact that it's a cartoon avatar, you know, my reality is in that, but at the same time, that gives me a little bit of a buffer zone to be somewhat of a character, you know, one more role that I play, but it's genuine. You know, it's not like it's a persona, but it's a genuine persona. But this, you know, here on this show is, you know, we take that persona off, and and there's not a lot of difference, but you know, it does give me, it gives me just that, like a buffer zone of, okay, you see this person on Twitter, And, you know, if you choose to engage with me, then we'll get to know each other, you right. know, and you'll see that there's not a lot of difference, but it kind of gives just a little bit of, you know, shielding to.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you talk about that. I think a lot of that, it's like acting, you know, when you act, and I'm not a good actor, but when you act, you really have to put yourself out there, you know, you really inhabit a different persona, that you bring yourself to it. And you really, you know, it's a lot of risk. And when you look at the people that we're talking about, there's an enormous amount of creativity out there mm-hmm. that people are expressing, you know, and I think that's the same thing. You know, people are either they're doing cosplay or they're writing stuff or doing podcasts. And, you know, I think that it enables people to kind of put themselves out there. You know, I mean, I think cosplay is, I haven't ever done it. My son has, but I think that's the same thing. I mean, you put yourself out there, you know, and then you go out in a group of people and you're going to be judged, you know, yep. and I think it's just a tremendous like release that allows you to do that. And it's amazing to see how many people in our Star Trek group are doing Star Trek or other related creative things. Mm-hmm. And you, I mean, look at you, you're doing all kinds of things.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I'm mostly just keeping myself from, being completely crazy. but I have, you know, I have a good time with it. And like that goes back to everything about this is that, you know, you can't always have a good time, but you can choose to have a good time as much as possible. Right. There are going to be times when it's inappropriate. There are going to be times when, you know, you have to be serious. But at the same time, you know, I've gotten into real meaningful discussions by being just a lark on Twitter. You know, you'll put something out there that's kind of a joke about this particular scene or that particular, you know, element of Trek. But it actually comes back to a real discussion or, you know, an opportunity to find out why that is important to somebody else. And I think it's
incredibly important to, you know, we can say I'm a 56 year old adult. Why am I, you know, watching TV shows and like, you know, fantasizing about them? But I think that there's something about having an inner life that's tremendously important. You know, one of the things that the former guy was, you know, criticized about or people would talk about is that he didn't read.
Yeah.
You know, and I just always think like, how can you understand other people if you don't consume fiction, you know, which allows you to get into other people's heads. Mm-hmm. That's the thing of, you know, that omniscient author can get you in someone else's head. You can empathize with other people. You can see how they feel. And I just think that having an inner life, whatever it's based on, having those thoughts, having those funny discussions that turn into something deeper, it makes your head work. It makes you think about something outside yourself. It makes you think about how other people operate, and it makes you a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to get super serious for a second, I just think it's so important, however you do it, to have that inner life so that you're thinking about more than just your next meal or your next trip to work or you know, whatever it is. You gotta have that inner life.
That makes a very good point. You've got to have something that is more than the mundane, right? And I don't understand, like, recently learning that there are people who aren't constantly in self-reflection or talking to themselves or have an inner monologue going or something, just a din in their brain. Man, what is that like? And, I can't imagine. That's got to be boring. But, you know, that inner life comes from, I don't think a lot of people or, you know, a good chunk of people haven't taken the time to go on the existential journey. You know, it requires.
I think people are afraid to. It's work.
Yeah. Well, it's it work is, and they look for scary. An easy answer. You know, I don't have to consider the existential if I consider, you know, a rewarding afterlife. I don't have to understand where I exist in a universe that is more immense than I will ever know. Mm. You know, and that you have to come to the realization that you aren't special to know that you are, right? In the larger existence, you know, all of the time that you haven't been here and all of the time that you won't be here in the future, you don't matter. You are made of matter, but you don't matter. Mm-hmm. All you have is this brief, incredibly brief, you know, hopefully 80 to 90, maybe 100 years where you can be effective, and you can only affect so much. And what do you want your sphere of influence to be?
Yeah.
You know, you get about, obviously this is very relevant these days, you get about 6 feet of influence at any given point. And what are you doing with that? You know, and things like Twitter and being able to talk to folks through this media and, you know, YouTube, et cetera. It shortens that 6 feet. It brings everyone closer into that bubble. But, you know, you still have to choose what impact you want to have.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, Political Dan was having no impact whatsoever. You know, I got no interactions with that stuff. I was just screaming into the void and getting Twitter strikes, you know. And since switching over to primarily Trek Focus, I've only been in jail one time. And
Twitter jail,
I,
you mean?
Yeah,
not
Twitter
the real
jail. Yeah, not actually.
That was
jail.
Just a few days ago, wasn't it?
It was just a few days ago, and I'd do it again because that guy was a jerk. but, you know. Come to that understanding, and then, you know, like, well, I think one of the prime examples is Rashid. I always like to give Rashid props because almost everything he does is through the filter of friendship and positivity.
Yeah, he's you know, so positive.
Yeah, and that was
and
one
he,
of
you know
the,
he shows pictures of himself and like he seems to get younger all the time.
All
like,
the time,
he
yeah,
shaves
that's
off
frustrating.
His beard. And, like, how did you get 20 years younger?
Yeah, no, it's I mean, it's good eating and well living. I think. I mean, if you've ever seen some of the dishes that his wife has made, it's you know, it's jelly, it's jealous, jealousy.
Shows those
inducing.
Those trains, the trains tracks.
The,
his kids
the
make.
Tracks his kid makes. Yeah, beautiful.
And I was watching one of them one day, and I heard train noises, and I was like, that's crazy. And of course, I live about 3 miles from the train tracks. And it was real trains, but it was
insane.
Kind of blew my mind a little bit.
You know, big love for the train. There's the train runs through town 2 blocks from my house. Conway was once upon a time in the record book for having the most railroad crossings in a 1 mile stretch of train track.
Anyway, I don't mean to interrupt you. So you were just talking about. What were you talking about?
Oh, the positivity, man.
the positivity.
Yeah. You know, bringing positivity to the Trek side of things. And a lot of that, too, was after it started with Discovery, when Discovery premiered. And I kind of went looking for, you know, what's the vibe on why do the Klingons look different? I just want to know, like, you know, is there an end universe or a writer's or a showrunner's explanation or, you know, and I stumbled into that side of, you know, the Mecha Random and the Doomcocks and the Midnight's Edge. And I realized that I wasn't getting the content that I anticipated, nor were I getting actual answers.
Right.
Which fortunately led me into the positive side of Trek YouTube with like Triangulum Studios and Steve Shives, you know, and eventually Jesse Gender and Trek on the Tube and all of these really great content creators who criticize the franchise in a critical thinking way,
right?
Not a critical way. Like, you know, there's a difference between dismantling the nuance and disagreeing with story choices than there is over, you know, attacking the physical appearance of actors who are just doing their life's work.
I mean, look, I when I first saw the first episode of Discovery, I was not a huge fan of it.
Yep.
I said, I'm not going to pay for all access to get this. So it was a long time. I somehow got a free trial later and I started to watch it. But the people whose response to it is simply, well, that's not real Trek. You know, I own this fandom and that's not real Trek. I don't really understand that. And, you know, and they want to attack it for, because, oh, they're all social justice warriors. There's not enough like straight white men. You know, there aren't any in the most recent season. And like, I don't get that as criticism. Look, I look at Discovery Now, and I think in the last season, did we really need a 2-episode love letter to Giorgio and the alternate universe in the middle of what was like a 10-episode season? You know, yeah. You can criticize it that way, but I just feel like I've really come to love the characters, love the cast. And maybe it's the time that we're in right now, but that cast seems to interact with us, the fans, mm-hmm. so much.
In a genuine way, you know?
I mean, like, my wife got me a Doug Jones cameo for my birthday.
He's so great.
He is so great.
Good at him. He's so good at him.
And Doug Jones doesn't know me from Adam, but, you know, like, and my wife gave him a few details, and he did a nice kind of 8-minute, you know, it was just so nice. It made me feel so good.
You feel like I've gotten several cameos from the crew, you know, Emily Counts and Doug and a couple others. They always make it feel like, you know, it is one-to-one. It is them to you. There is an aspect of it that you feel like they know, because they know you feel you about what you feel about Star Trek, right? They get it in a level. But yeah. You're right. This current cast.
And then what's better than Noah Averback Katz? You know, a guy who was a Trekkie as a kid.
One of us.
Yeah, and he's like, that's the dream, right? Just to actually be on the show.
Oh yeah,
and he's so into interacting with the fans, and he's and obviously you had him. I know you had him on your show.
Oh yeah, that was a great interaction.
That was great, and I love that. But to me, also, a lot of that is what Star Trek's really about. You know, that their attitude towards people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have really come to love Discovery. I love Lower Decks. I think it was the best first season of any Star Trek show.
Yep.
And you can just, the thing that you love about it, or that I love about it, is that it's so obvious that the people who made it just love Star Trek, you know, and so that's what they're doing. They're showing you how much they love it.
You're old enough to know back in the day that if you wanted to get the fun inside scoop on Trek, you had to get the Nitpicker's Guides.
Yeah.
Where they went down and they pointed out all the little foibles or all the cool things. And recently, one of those things was someone talking about, you know, did you know there's a thing in the MSD of the Enterprise? You know, and it's been in the technical manual since the technical manual was printed. But it was also, those kinds of things were in the Nitpicker's Guide. And that was the fun stuff, like just kind of breaking down Trek where we made tiny little mistakes and things were a little weird. And that is what Lower Decks was. That is that is an animated Nitpicker's Guide. And it's great.
But it's done so lovingly.
It
though.
Is.
It's not done, you know, sarcastic. Well, it's a little sarcastic, but it's not, you know, like, you know, they talk about how so many of the people who made Lower Decks also make Rick and Morty.
Yep.
And Rick and Morty is so nihilistic and so negative on everything. I mean, I do not recommend to anyone that they ever binge watch Rick and Morty, because you will not come out of that.
End up in a dark place.
but Lower Decks is done from a completely different viewpoint. And yeah, it's people who just love it, and they want to just throw in a million references and guest stars. I know a lot of people don't like it, but I absolutely love it. I can't wait for the next season of it.
I'm so excited for it. And Prodigy too. I'm loving, there's never been a better time to be engaged with this. But
I love Janeway so much.
I'm so excited.
I really do.
I'm so
I excited. Love Janeway. My mantra on Janeway is homicidal Janeway is good Janeway.
Is the best Janeway.
Janeway is best Janeway.
That's right.
And I just, you know, when she gets in that mode,
there's a whole face and a hairstyle that goes with
I would follow that captain.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Anywhere. Through a year of hell, as the case may be. But when, like you said, when I came to realize that there was this this army against the new stuff, as it were, and I couldn't get any, like, you know, production answers to those changes, I just instantly was like, okay, I don't care why they made those changes, because I'm not going to be a part of that side of this.
Yeah.
Because if the folks who put the labels on the tins say it's Star Trek, it is. I can choose to how I want to incorporate that into my enjoyment, but I don't get to say that it's not. You know,
yeah. I'm not a huge fan of the Kelvin universe, but yeah. I'm not out here saying, well, that's not really Star Trek.
It's
different. Yeah. And some people really love it. And I'm old enough that I don't remember watching Star Trek, the original series, when it was being broadcast, but I know that I did because I remember I was about 2.5 years old when they moved it to 10 o'clock at night and it was too late for me to
see. It's too late for you to stay up and watch.
But growing up in the 70s, I mean, Star Trek was
everywhere. You know, it was everywhere.
The series was, I had posters on my wall and everything. And, it's funny, you go back now and you look at that series. And there are so many bad episodes that are just hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something, you know, there's some thread that runs through everything there. And there, of course, are the great episodes like, you know, like Amok Time. It's just such a great Mirror, Mirror and City on the Edge of Forever.
And a piece of the action.
So many great episodes. But even the bad episodes, they have that. There's that thing. And, you know, when I grew up, when I was a little kid, we didn't have a color TV.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd watch everything in black and white. And when I saw Star Trek in color for the first time, oh my God. Yeah.
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 That's what a lot of people forget about. The production design of Trek at the time was just as much about blowing out the primary colors on those fancy new TV sets that RCA, parent company of NBC, which Star Trek wanted to sell, and so you know that color had to pop in the window, and I mean Trek just cranked it up to 11 when it came.
I had a ViewMaster.
Yeah.
Me the Star Trek slides, and it was like 3D and color, and I was like, wow, what is this? This is a whole amazing. new thing. Yeah. So I grew up with Star Trek, and we were so excited when Motion Picture came out, and I don't want to go there because I didn't love it. I know a lot of people do.
Have you come to endear it though? Maybe a little.
I mean, the scene where they're in the shuttlecraft, the
cinematic perfection. You mean?
I love what they did with that on Lower Decks. How they extended it out to like
ridiculous. Oh yeah,
that was great.
That's a handsome lady.
It was great to see all those people again. To me, Wrath of Khan was, this is what I wanted, and so it was definitely a repair of what I didn't get in Motion Picture. I can watch TMP now, but
yeah,
it was not, you know. And it's funny, it was only 10 years right between the end of Star Trek and Motion Picture, and yet it felt like forever. I was a little kid, so those were the years I was growing
too.
Up.
You know, the difference in production design between the two is incredible. But I think something like Wrath of Khan stands out is that set the tone for Trek till almost, the end of Voyager. Those ripples played out through the rest of the franchise until modern day Trek, I think. Enterprise kind of shifted tones, but just that look, the production design, you can see more of a connective tissue from that era to like the Next Generation and the way things looked and worked than there, it felt like such a disconnect between original Trek to the Motion Picture and between the Motion Picture and Wrath of Khan. Of course, there's 15 years fair. Between the two.
That's fair. And then I do think that because you had these long running series, some of which had some story arcs in them, like Deep Space Nine, they were able to do some, really, I think, some very interesting stories, episodically. I know it's everybody says this, but I love In the Pale Moonlight. I think that is just a fantastic episode.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
With what Sisko is going through and the scene where he confronts Garak and is so angry at him for assassinating the Vulcan ambassador. And Garak basically says, when you came to me, you knew that I was going to do the things that you couldn't do. You knew it then. So don't act all, don't act all self-righteous about it. Yep. It's kind of like that scene in the bar where Quark and Garak are talking about root beer and the Federation. I love that scene.
It's insidious.
But after a while, you start to like it.
That's right.
But, you know, they were able to kind of investigate some of that stuff where your characters become a lot more three-dimensional. They have negative sides to them. And you know, Enterprise, when it first came out, I was not a huge fan. And I recently went back and I rewatched the whole thing. And then I did it again with my wife. So I've done it twice in the last couple of months. And looking at Archer, I mean, he comes out of season three with pretty serious PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
He had to do some things.
Yeah.
And he is not happy about it. Like when he had needed that warp coil, you know, and he went back and he stole it. He just took it.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and a lot of times in episodic TV, people will do things. And then the next episode, it's like that other stuff never happened. But I liked the fact that, you know, at the beginning of season four, he was in really bad shape. He was feeling it. And, you know, I think that as the show has matured and the whole universe has matured, it's allowed them to go in and investigate some of these things where, yeah, the people you like, the characters you like, they're not always good people. You know, like my thing about Janeway, mm-hmm. You know, Janeway is not always a good person.
Nope.
And you just have to go, this is a real person. She's got to be captain of the ship. She's got to make these decisions. She's got to decide what to do about Tuvix. You know,
she is. She's the definition of lawful neutral. You know, she knows.
I guess so.
She knows what her right is, and she will go with that more. She listens to counsel, but at the end of the day, you know, for all the behind the scenes practical reasons that Tuvix couldn't survive because that's not how that show works. you know, but at the same time. She knew what had to be done, and she knew that it had to be her to do it.
The
doctor wasn't going to do it.
No, he refused to do it, right? He said, I can't do that.
And she wasn't going to ask anyone.
And her face at the end of that episode as she's walking away, it's just, you know. And I think that, you know, like I'm a big fan of Stanislav Lem. Bear with me because I'm going somewhere with this.
Go, bring it.
So Lem is, I don't know if you're familiar with Stanislav Lem, but he's a science fiction writer who grew up behind the Iron Curtain. And he became acquainted with Western science fiction through stuff that slipped through the cracks. And he became a science fiction writer. He wrote Solaris, a bunch of other things that you may have encountered. But he had some very fierce criticisms of science fiction about what a failure it was and how 99.9% of it's trash and, you know, like the pew-pews and the bug-eyed monsters and stuff. And, you know, the point he made was that there is something that can be done in science fiction that can't be done anywhere else, but nobody's doing it. And I think if Lem looked at Star Trek, he would by and large say it's trash, like it uses the trashy stuff like everybody else does. But that sometimes, you know, and this is what one of the writers that he really liked was Philip K. Dick. And what he said about Dick was that he uses all the same trashy tools that everybody else uses, but he does something with it that's interesting and different. And I think that when Star Trek's at its best, it does that. It kind of fulfills that. Here's something you couldn't do if it wasn't science fiction. And we're going to look at it. We're going to investigate it. And yeah, there's phasers and photon torpedoes and, you know, aliens who look like humans with latex on their foreheads. But we're going to use those basic tools and we're going to do something that's actually a little bit transcendent, a little bit interesting, a little bit different. And I love finding those things in Star Trek. You know, I despite the criticism and I tend to be aware of the criticism all the time because those things stick in my head. But, you know, that's when it's at its best. And I think, because there's been so many hundreds of episodes and movies and they've had the opportunity to, sometimes they really get where you no one else can go.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and to the broader point of sci-fi, things like that, stories that can't be told in any other kind of context, like, you know, that explore some interesting ideas like The Shape of Water. It's ultimately, you know, big time love story, but, you know, through a sci-fi fantasy, element, and, you know, that kind of unique take on a love story couldn't be told outside of the, you know, that conveyance. And Trek has an opportunity now with over 800, hours of such, to, you know, we can fill a lot of gaps and kind of real quick on, you know, just an extension of that point. A conversation about the best way to introduce someone to Star Trek these days. And, you know, a lot of the advice was, oh, start here with this episode or start there with that episode. And my advice was ask that person, what kind of story do they like? Because now there's a story in Trek in almost every genre. You want a Bond like, fun thing? You've got, Our Man Bashir. There's heist stories. There's, gambling story. You know, there's the Royale. You know, that's some intrigue. And you got something, you know, like we said, a piece of the action. You can have a gangster story. And so Trek now has enough of a catalog that introduce that person through something that they're going to be willing to engage with. My thing has been not overwhelming with backstory, letting the story tell itself and, you know, answering questions after the fact than rather than going through, one more thing. And the person, you know, they're going to disengage. They're not going to want to, get into it because they're like, oh God, I don't feel like I know all this stuff.
That's really a good point. And one of the things, I'm a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien, as I think I've mentioned to you before. And Tolkien, you know, as he wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, was also writing this huge world building thing that he didn't even think was ever going to be published. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think really comes across when you read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings is that it is situated in a larger world, that he isn't going to explain everything, mm-hmm. but you see the kind of the reality of this larger world and that you don't have to go back and explain the whole backstory. In fact, it enhances the story to know that there's a big backstory that you don't know all the details about.
Yeah.
How to introduce anyone to any great series that you love. Like I'm a big Terry Pratchett fan also, and I know what my favorite Terry Pratchett story is. I would never start someone off there. Because I want to say, well, in order to get to the great stuff, you need to get to the good stuff first so that you can really appreciate the great stuff.
Right.
You know, like, don't start with the best. Start with the good and then work your way up to the best so you can really appreciate it.
But yeah,
and of course, sometimes you lose them before they get to the best stuff. And well, that's life.
Horror. We got horror. You know, you want.
We got everything. We got
comedy. We got
space
comedy.
Battles.
Yeah.
Space battles.
Pew-pews. We got the pew-pews.
Intrigue. You know? Love stories.
All of it. And it's really, and there's so, sci-fi does that really well. There's so much out there. You get into Stargate, you get the same, talk about a franchise that gives Trek a run for its money on. I think Doctor Who and Stargate are the only ones that come close to, maybe The Simpsons, but is that really a franchise?
I love Babylon 5, I love Battlestar Galactica, but I think that none of them are as complete as Star Trek.
Well, and I think, you know, you can argue cultural impact, but there, you know, you could argue that against the other star themed franchise that looms off in the galaxy far, far away.
I love Star Wars.
I do too.
I think there's 2.5 great movies there, and a whole world of other stuff.
Like, we didn't really need to know why his last name was Solo, guys. It's fine.
Well, yeah, that's my son is like that. It's like, why did we need to explain his blaster and the fuzzy dice? We didn't need to explain that.
They're all of those things. Obviously, yeah. It's those elements are there because he's Han fucking Solo. That's why, you know. I guess they could have told us his middle name for all that's worth. And speaking of, I just realized I'm wearing, you know, I'm representing. So
there you go.
John, as you know how the show goes, I could talk to people forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
But that just means that we get to come back to this at some point. Because there's no way we get to everything that matters. I mean, you know, when it comes to...
I honestly cannot imagine someone else listening to this conversation.
People say that. And then what's funny is, you know, contemporary note recorded with Amins Ra, on Twitter. Excellent cosplayer. And she's been, you know, very much the same. Oh, I don't know why anybody would want, but thank you for having me. And then, you know, just the little chit chat, chatter about it on Twitter. People are excited. They're going to be excited to hear you too. Okay. You know, cool. You know, don't be afraid to stand out. It's, you know, it's interesting to see, the show has an audience that catches up, right? Older episodes continue to get plays and new episodes eventually catch up. And it's just like, it's like everything good in life, you know, let it age, gets better, you know, just
like a fine wine.
Exactly. Like good bourbon, like fine wine. Exactly. Age. Us, you know, men of a certain generation, men of a certain age. We just, it shows in our face and in our hair, the fine aging.
I shaved for you, Dan.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. You know. I get in trouble with Kathy every time I shave. So, you know, I gotta temper my beard trimmings with how much crap I want to put up with. But is there anything you want to say on the tail end of all of this?
You mean like plug something?
Yeah, you got anything to plug? You want to talk about
anything? I do a little tiny bit. I have published so far one article on Treksphere.
Very cool.
Which was about Kodos the Executioner and trolley problems. So that's, you know. Well, I recommend you go read it. I have another one that they're looking at right now. You know, it's in the editing stage, and a third one that I'm currently writing, and all of them are on topics that are fascinating to me.
Oh, well, that's how you write. That's the best kind of writing is to, you know, you have to entertain yourself first or you won't get it done.
And then I am currently talking to a couple of other people in our little Trek family about the upcoming miniseries that's based on Isaac Asimov's story, Foundation. Yes.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm not jumping the gun by saying that we're talking about trying to do some kind of podcast related to that. We're still in the what do we really want to do and how do we host it and how do we, you know, what's the theme, what's the structure, but we're talking about it. So I'm hoping that we're actually going to get around to actually launching something and doing a you know, I'm currently going back and reading through the books and there's a lot of good ideas floating around, and I hope that we'll get something good out of it. So those
well, anything
are going
to
be
I
my
can
things.
Do to help you.
Well, I actually
launch and
might
want
to sort of pick your brains as to how you, some of the nuts and bolts of how you get your from this conversation to publishing it up on the
absolutely.
Web.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll
so maybe offline
we
talk
you
about
bet.
Some of that stuff.
Of course.
So that's about it. Otherwise, I just lurk around on Twitter and occasionally throw in my still pretty snarky 2 cents on people's stuff. And,
you know, you don't always want to have a shiny 2 cents. You need a little rubbed up penny from time to time.
People need
to
know what I think about things.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they do. They need to know.
There's, we lack so much representation. People need to know our thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know,
of course,
not enough old white guys.
Yeah, exactly. Not all old white guys. Well, John, again, thank you so much for taking
the
time.
Well, thank you for having me. I really
appreciate
it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. We're going to come back to this again. You know, of course, thank you, dear listeners, for giving us your time, attention, and your ears this week. Hope we've earned them again for next week. If you enjoyed the show, the best way to support is please share your favorite episodes from our podcast on anchor.fm. But if you are super interested in helping, you can provide material support via Patreon at patreon.com/DANDECKR. Otherwise, the show will always be free every Thursday, ad-free, and continuing until I can no longer do it. So with that, thank you. And from the Toad Suck Studio in beautiful Central Arkansas, I say good night. All right.